So it's a great pleasure to have Naomi and Truman here. So I first met Naomi, I guess it was in 2002, maybe when I was a postdoc at Princeton. And I quickly gravitated towards the engineering department where she was because I was so interested in learning about the approaches that she and her colleagues use to study dynamical systems and collective behavior. And then I guess it's been about 10 years now since Truman, Naomi, and I have been funded so continuously over this period to work together to try to bring together a truly sort of interdisciplinary team. We just got our grant renewed for another 5 years, so this is our kickoff meeting to sort of see where we're going to go over the next 5 years. So it's great that you can join us. We're going to have dinner tonight. If people would like to join, we're more than welcome. Please drop me an email so I can know the numbers. Naomi and Truman are around until, I guess, you might be available tomorrow, but certainly today for meetings. And so again, just drop me or Jacob an email and we'll try and set you up meetings. And I don't know if you're going to talk about the flock, the dance work that you do?
Just briefly.
Okay, yeah. Good. Okay. I'll mention that if you want me to mention it.
Okay.
Great.
So, well, thanks. It's great to be here. So I've been fascinated by the notion of dynamical groups for a couple of decades now, as Ian mentioned, for lots of reasons, but one in particular is the remarkable resilience that they seem to have as they move together. In particular, what I mean by that is their ability at the level of the group to be both responsive to cues and environment and also robust to noise and disturbance. So in my research program, what we do is work with analytically tractable and generalizable models to help explain how what individuals do and the way they respond to social cues and environmental cues might explain what we observe in terms of resilience at the level of the group. And
so analytic tractability allows us to come up with testable predictions in terms of a few, you know, small number of parameters. Generalizability then allows us to think about deriving and explaining mechanisms for resilience in groups, but for more than one particularized species. And then both tractability and generalizability together allow us to also think about how we might do systematic design, say, of technological groups, like robotic systems that can inherit some of these remarkable properties from the animal groups. So what I want to do today, since I have kind of half of a lecture slot here, is very briefly give you a little idea of what we've done in the context of a range of systems, and then I want to kind of dig into the particular example of a recent work that we've done on studying resilience in the regulation of foraging of desert harvester ants. So I want to begin just by showing this beautiful video. You've probably seen some like it. These are starlings filmed over the train station in Rome, in the winter months. I think, you know, just by looking at this, at least, you know, visually, it looks like the group is kind of amazingly responsive to this predator, while the individuals seem to be almost immune to disturbance and uncertainty as they move in such sort of synchronized patterns. So we studied this with the scientists Cavagna and Giardina using an analytically tractable model. We were interested in the role of the social network, so who's responding to whom and the ability of the group to efficiently manage uncertainty. Here's another video. This I actually just took off the web. This is a beautiful school of fish. Again, they seem to be sort of immune to what must be a lot of uncertainty and disturbance, and yet at the level of the group, they seem to be able to respond to some kind of change in the environment because they move from this circular motion into a polarized motion. And again, we have been studying, as Ian mentioned, for many years now, using data and simulation, but also these analytically tractable models. In this case, we were looking at not just role of network structure, but the role of how social interactions, who's communicating with whom, can change because individuals are moving relative to one another, and how this plays into understanding mechanisms that explain consensus decision making, even when very little or very few of the individuals are getting information about the environment or have preferences. We've also looked at this fascinating problem of how honeybees make decisions in nest site selection, so how they're able to pick nest sites of high enough quality so they can manage over the course of the winter. We were particularly interested in the question of how they're able to flip a coin rather than be undecided when they're presented with alternatives that are of near equal quality. And so it's very well known that you know, how they pick sort of best of N when they're you know, searching out sites. So something like 3 or 4% of them go out, search out sites, come back. They use the waggle dance to advertise their site. It was a few years ago that it was also discovered that they use the stop signaling, which is this cross inhibition in the context not just of foraging but also in nest site selection. So this is you know, a bee who has committed to one site will headbutt a bee who's dancing for another site, and this has an effect of tempering the dance, and it allows us to understand mechanisms for how they're able to flip a coin when they're presented with near equal quality sites. And so we developed, or we studied these using, again, analytically tractable models, first in the sort of the well-mixed and the mean field context, but then we developed these models for agent-based decision-making. Here it's actually a variation of a hop field network, so we're trying to introduce notions of excitability and inhibition in the network setting to understand how groups make these kinds of decisions and how they do it with such flexibility and robustness. We've also sort of deliberately looked at a role of heterogeneity, individual differences. That's actually the theme of our new continuing grant. But here it's in the context of, these are, you're looking at data from zebras that my student Will Scott collected in Kenya with my colleague Dan Rubenstein. But here the idea is that there's heterogeneity in speed and agility. And we're interested in how these animals, so they're evading a little robo-lion that Will is driving. It's just a remote control vehicle with a lion puppet on it. These are actually two different groups that instead of splitting, they move together. It's really interesting. There's two males, the red dots, and then the mother foal pairs are way out in front. But we're interested in how they organize themselves, you know, how, again, they're able to sort of efficiently respond to this this predator or threat. It wasn't super scary, but and again, we're using these sort of analytically tractable models. So thinking about the physics, and I'm using simple but tractable models again in terms of small number of parameters to understand the role of these individual differences and also social and environmental cues in what happens. So Ian mentioned. I also wanted just to point out that we're also interested in human collective behavior, and I've been particularly interested in the context of dance because dancers have been trained to be highly physically aware of others around them. So I've been working with a couple of different choreographers, actually with a composer as well. So this is an early project from about 10 years ago where we looked at, it's called Flock Logic, and we actually have a paper associated with this. We looked at what happens when you give dancers the rules that we use to model schooling and flocking. And then more recently, we worked on a project which is really a social decision-making, social negotiation, where dancers are used. This is all sort of rule-based improvisational dance, so they're making choices on the fly in response to some social cues. And we actually used an evolutionary dynamic model, replicator-mutator dynamics, to explore the role of sort of global cues, and it became part of the making of the dance. And this was actually premiered in New York in 2016. But here's a new paper, 2019. It took us a while to find a journal that's interested in art making and science, but we did. And so this, if you're interested, I can tell you more about that. We also do this kind of work in the context of robotics. As I said, we're trying to, you know, because we're abstracting out in all of these examples, you know, we're starting with a particularized system, and then we try to abstract out into generalized models, which we can then turn into systematic design methodologies. And so this is just something that we did in the lab. So we've built a whole honeybee nest site selection story into a whole framework for sort of based on nonlinear dynamics for multi-agent, multi-option decision making. So you're looking at two agents making decisions between going to the right and going to the left. And we do this in terms of a couple parameters, U and C here. Here the robots are those parameters are being affected by colored lights, and they're sensing the intensity and the color of the light and responding, and so making agreement decisions and disagreement decisions. We've also done a work with robots in the field. So these are underwater gliders that I've worked with. So this was many years ago, but this was out in Monterey Bay, California. Here we're using them as an observational platform. So for instance, in 2003, you're looking in the sort of southern part, this is off the coast of California, at these vehicles moving. They're going up and down, but they're moving in these coordinated patterns. Here the idea was that they were trying to climb gradients in the temperature field, so we were tracking cold water after an upwelling event. We went back a few years later and explored some of our methodologies for designing motion patterns. So here you're looking at a 20 kilometer by 40 kilometer and then like 1,000 meter deep volume of water. This is up near Santa Cruz off the coast, California again. So they're moving in these patterns designed to maximize information in the data they were collecting, again, sort of minimize uncertainty in their ability to estimate fields. So this is kind of, we actually use it for environmental monitoring, this notion of collective behavior. So let me move on and then focus in on this particular project so you get a sense of what we're doing with models and how we use them and then how we generalize them. And this is a fascinating project on resilience of the regulation of foraging in these red harvester ants in the desert of Arizona. This is work with Renato Pagliaras, a PhD student who just completed his dissertation in July, and Deborah Gordon, who many of you may know. She's a field biologist and a professor at Stanford. She's been studying these ants for over 30 years. So these are ants that go out along this foraging trail, and they spread out and they look for seeds that have been blown by the wind. They don't leave pheromone trails for that reason. So they don't need to go where somebody else has been. They actually spread out. And then once they find a seed, they come back along the same foraging trail into the nest entrance chamber, and they greet the available foragers. They exchange a cuticular hydrocarbon so that the available foragers know that they've been outside. They know if they've been successful in getting a seed. And essentially, what Deborah knows very well is that these interactions excite the available foragers to go out. So the more interactions they have, the higher the rate of incoming ants, the more likely it is that the ants will go out, because it gives them some kind of measure of the plentifulness of the seeds or the conditions for foraging outside. But they have a very critical trade-off in terms of water. So they metabolize water from the fats in the seeds, but they lose water, especially on these very hot and dry days. And so they have to balance this. And Deborah's found that on these very hot and dry days, the colonies with the highest reproductive success seem to be foraging less. So this is suggestive of there being a connection between sensitivity to environmental parameters and fitness of the group. And so she came to us to ask us, how with models we might help her understand, how is this trade-off managed, particularly on longer timescales than she'd studied, so minutes to hours. And how might we understand how that these ants are able to manage this trade-off, and how might we understand, in terms of a small number of parameters, what's governing behavior and what's distinguishing colonies, because not all of them are doing a good job in managing these hot, dry days. So this is a paper that I'll tell you about. It was published last year in PLOS Computational Biology. But then we also went on this notion of then how do we ask other questions. So this was you'll see it's a population level model, and we want to ask questions about role of individual differences perhaps inside of colonies. So what about variability? So how do we how do we generalize to explain resilience, maybe extending to other kinds of systems, other animals? What's the role of individual differences in other heterogeneity? And what are possibilities for sort of interventions or control strategies if you want to enhance or manage these kinds of spreading processes? And so I'll talk a little bit about that, and there's some new papers on this. So let me just start by showing you some of the data that we collected. So Renato, not me, went out with Deborah over 2015, 2016, and 2017 at the end of sort of end of August, early September, and collected data. These are, you know, these are like timestamps of ants coming in and timestamps of ants going out, which you can filter and get incoming and outgoing rates. And so what you're looking at here is just an example of that on August 20th, 2016, when it was 25.9 degrees Celsius and 57% relative humidity, two different colonies, same day. So blue is incoming foraging rate, red is outgoing foraging rate. There's a couple things to notice. Sort of at the beginning, the outgoing rate is greater than the incoming rate, and then it tends to equilibrate. So you get this kind of quasi-steady state where incoming is equal to outgoing. But the other big thing to notice is that one colony is more than twice, you know, going at more than twice the rate as the other. Right, here's some more data. These are the same kinds of plots. The green line is the sort of integrated number of foragers out there. So when it becomes horizontal, you're at this kind of quasi-steady state. But this is the same colony on two different dates. So when it was you know, cooler and more humid and hotter and less humid, so cooler day, they're foraging substantially higher rates. This is ants per second as a function of time of day, higher rates than they are on this hotter, so that this colony has assessed this as a hotter day and is foraging less. This is another way of just looking at the same data. So this is outgoing rate as a function of incoming rate. So you can see the outgoing rate is above the diagonal, meaning it's higher than incoming rate, and then it equilibrates right on the diagonal where incoming is equal to outgoing. And the same thing goes on here. It's just the quasi-steady state here is at a lower rate. Interestingly, this is another colony on yet a different day, and this colony doesn't even sustain foraging. It goes out and comes right back in. We call that loop foraging. And it's interesting because it's the same roughly the same temperature and humidity as this colony, but this one assesses it as much, much sort of hotter and drier conditions. It shouldn't be out. Okay, so how do we explain this? The first step was to develop this model. And actually, we were inspired by previous work by Jacob Davidson to think about, you know, this map, you know, starting from the open loop, you know, just sort of what's going on inside the nest in terms of this, you know, incoming ants. So this sort of, you know, train of ants coming in, a train of ants going out, what's inside? And so we do that using models of excitability, sort of straight out of neuronal dynamics. So thinking about this notion of these interactions leading to, you know, ants getting excited once they get enough interactions. And so the first stage of our model is simply, you know, what is the stimulus that comes out of these interactions? So stimulus here is S, and this is just a simple linear integrator, so or a low-pass filter. So there's just sort of a step up in stimulus, and then there's a sort of a leak. You know, you forget after, you know, tau units of time. And then the second stage is then how the ants respond to that stimulus. And here we're using the Fitzhugh-Nagumo, it's a nonlinear oscillator model. So essentially, this is a model that takes the stimulus and gives us oscillations. We're going to think about every positive oscillation as an ant going out. Okay. And so the idea here is that we fix kind of all the parameters so that we get sort of the full gamut of possibilities for dynamics, and we focus in on a single parameter that can change that we refer to as its, say, susceptibility to these interactions. And it's a parameter that if you change it, you're changing the frequency of these oscillations. So this is a frequency tunable model, and the parameter of interest here we call C. And so, you know, the dynamics would look something like that. Here's this spike train of ants coming in. This is what happens after you pass it through this leaky integrator. So that's the stimulus. Here's the oscillator. So you're getting oscillations when the stimulus is above some critical value and below some critical value. So if it's too small, you're in a sort of a quiescence. If it's too high, you're in a saturated state. And that's being governed by this susceptibility C. And so I don't have time to go into it, but the model is such that we can actually, with some assumptions, like that the incoming rate is a Poisson process, we can actually analytically say some things about what's going to happen. So in particular, if you tell me what the average incoming rate is, I can compute or approximate for you what the average outcoming rate is. So we have this approximation using this timescale separation in the model for the period of the oscillation as a function of susceptibility C. And also using this ergodicity, we can compute this probability distribution function for what the stimulus is at steady state. And so, for instance, we can approximate what this sort of mean outgoing rate is as a function of mean incoming rate as a function of C. So these are these curves, and when they cross this dashed line, this is going to give us a prediction for what that quasi-steady state would be. And this is what happens in simulation, just to show you the approximation does a pretty good job. Interestingly, when C, your susceptibility, is low enough, it doesn't actually go above this dashed line. That's going to be interesting in a moment, because you won't be able to get a quasi-steady state. You're going to have to come right back in. It explains that loop foraging that I talked about. So then to close the loop, right, because I just told you about the model for the kind of the open loop, incoming ants, outgoing ants. But of course, the outgoing ants, they forage and they become the incoming ants. And if we want to understand the whole process over this order of minutes to hours, we have to close the loop and understand that. And so that's sort of key. And we do something very simple here. We model the foraging as a time delay. And this we use a chi-square distribution, which is actually modeled from Deborah's data. Right. So it only depends upon a single parameter, which is sort of the average time that colony spends searching for a seed. Right. And this is what those distributions look like. They're sort of left skewed distributions. So now we have two parameters, C and D, right, that are going to explain our model. And so we're able to, for instance, we actually use queuing theories, some nice results that allow us to predict what this, both that we're going to get a sort of a stable equilibrium, these quasi-steady states, so robust to noise, but also how this quasi-steady state, is affected by the susceptibility. And there's this critical value below which you're going to get just trivial foraging, because the quasi-steady state will be at zero. And so this is what we can predict analytically, that you're going to get these kinds of curves that these are just simulations that then sort of land along this line, except if your susceptibility is below the critical value, you can't see it because you're stuck here, no trivial foraging. Okay, so that's all well and good, but I haven't said anything yet about what's our hypothesis about how the ants are assessing and responding to the environment? Okay, so this is our hypothesis, and that is, this is based on, lots of discussions with Deborah, and actually, Renato being out there and realizing that the ants, every morning are in a nest that has the same temperature and humidity as any other day. So the hypothesis is that instead of having, the population always use the same C, that if you haven't gone out yet, you have some kind of default susceptibility. You don't know what kind of weather it is. In fact, the days change so seemingly randomly, you can't even predict, because yesterday was nice, that today will be nice. So that we call that C sub U, that's your uninformed susceptibility. But once you as an ant are exposed to the environment, you come back and then you're in this block, because you have adjusted your susceptibility. We call that C sub I. So we're doing this very simply. Of course, there could be lots of variability among ants, but we want to show that with just now, we're going to have a total of four parameters. We have our capital D. We have to keep track of the total number of ants N, and now C is, we have two of them, C uninformed and C informed. Okay, so we keep track, and we use kind of a probabilistic thinning, so we keep track of what fraction have been out and what fraction haven't, and then we use a sort of a probabilistic to decide if an oscillation is actually an ant going out or not. Okay, so this is sort of the entirety of the model, and so this is sort of a restating of the hypothesis that the differences among colonies and the response to different environmental conditions, temperature and humidity, are the result of differences in how the forages assess temperature and humidity and in how this influences their response to interactions with incoming foragers, right? Their change in their susceptibility to, you know, how many of these interactions do they need before they're excited enough to go out. And actually, Deborah has done recent work that suggests this depends on variation in the neurophysiology of biogenic amines, such as dopamine. So she's looking at, you know, how colonies might differ by how much dopamine expression they have. So this is the same plot I showed you before, where we were assuming that, you know, no matter what, you were always using the same kind of susceptibility. And then here's a sort of a cartoon of what would happen if we imagine that gradually the population, as it goes outside, is changing how susceptible it is. And so there are two different examples here. One is the green curve, one's the black curve. They both, in this little cartoon, start with the same default susceptibility of 5, so they're following this purple curve, but then they slowly switch the green colony to 2, and so they land there for their steady state, and the black colony has assessed it as being super hot and dry, and so they've downgraded their susceptibility so far that they actually go out and come in. So this is just a kind of example, but let me show you, let's go back to these three data sets. So what we can show, so we're not trying to track where every ant is at every moment. We're trying to qualitatively recover all the whole range of behaviors that we saw in the 3 years of collecting data. And so here's our model. And with these four parameters, we can qualitatively get these different kinds of behaviors. So this is the sort of the same colony, the same sort of uninformed susceptibility, and then the assess the environment differently on these two different days, and we get kind of the high steady state foraging and the low steady state foraging. And this one, we have an example where, you know, it assesses it as very hot and dry, and it essentially goes out and comes back in. Okay, and we do this for all the data that we have, and I just want to sort of categorize that for you in these four different kinds of behavioral regimes. So we can classify in terms of the CI and CU. So I have CU, this uninformed susceptibility versus informed susceptibility on this plot, when both are below this critical value of trivial foraging. In the morning, you don't think it's nice out, you go, somebody goes out, finds out it's not nice out, and nobody else goes out much. This is the example when you think it's nice in the morning, you go out and you find it's super hot and dry, so you come back in, right? This is the example where you think it's nice, you go out and it's nice, right, and you stay out. This is an interesting example where you don't think it's particularly nice out. I didn't show you this. This is another data set on the top and a simulation on the bottom. So we saw some data sets like this where it's kind of like not much is happening. It's as if they're not very susceptible, and it takes a while. So there's this sort of delayed foraging, we call it, right, where you're actually assessing the environment as better than you thought. And then so you get this kind of like nothing, 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 then you get this burst going in. Okay, so this is sort of the story that we told to try to understand. And, you know, Deborah, we're coming up with new testable predictions. She's painting ants, and we're thinking about, for instance, can we keep track of, you know, who's going out, how many times they're going out, how much time they're waiting in the nest in between times that they go out. And so this gets into questions about individual differences and things that we can't tell with our model, which is really kind of population-wise. So we sought to generalize. We moved on to epidemiological models, right? Because the idea is that if this is really kind of a susceptibility and this is really like an infectious process, we're talking about infection, like a behavioral infection, this, you know, susceptibility to forage. And so we use, so this is just thinking about a model which is actually out there in the literature, just hadn't been studied very significantly, not with analysis. And so this is called SIRI. So you have susceptible, infected, recovered, and then the recovereds can be reinfected and gain partial immunity, so they lower their susceptibility, or they can have compromised immunity and they increase their susceptibility. So SIS and SIR are special cases. That's when you have either full or no immunity. And so this is just the sort of a version of the standard model where you're looking at the fraction that are susceptible, infected, and recovered. So now beta here is the infection rate, delta is the recovery rate, beta hat is this new after first exposure reinfection rate. So it's mimicking this idea in the model of the ants. And you know the simplex, so this is where everybody's infected, everybody's susceptible, everybody's recovered. In SIR, you get either this sort of infection-free domain or the epidemic domain. In SIS, you get infection-free or the endemic solution. We get all three of those, but we also get this new regime, which is a bistable regime, where you can become infection-free or you can get this resurgent epidemic that I showed you. And this is just a note to say that these match up to the four behavioral regimes I showed you in terms of the susceptibilities in our ant model. So this is sort of a first step in generalizing this. Here's a simulation just to show you, it's super interesting, this resurgent epidemic. So here, this is like fraction of the initial small fraction of the population is infected, and it looks like you've gotten rid of the infection. And yet, for this very long period of time, because you're getting close to that infection-free solution, and then you can get this burst. And this is all because of, you know, introducing this idea of the possibility of compromised immunity. You know, we also then generalize this to these compartmental models on networks. So now it's individual-wise. So individual J has a probability of being susceptible, infected, or recovered. And now you can have the whole wealth of heterogeneity. So sort of the infection rate from J, from K, the Kth individual who's infected to the Jth individual can be different from every other pairwise interaction. Everybody can have different recovery rates, and also the reinfection rates can all be heterogeneous. And so you can have these networks where they're directed, and some don't have any connections. And you can encode that in these matrices. So the B are all those infection rates, B hat are all those reinfection rates, delta, or gamma is this diagonal matrix of recovery rates, B star is this convex combination of the two Bs. And so now, instead of having just two reproduction numbers, like we had in the well-mixed case, where you're looking at, this is the spectral radius of this matrix, this is the spectral radius of this matrix, we have four numbers that keep track of all the heterogeneity and the network structure that allow us to understand how we get all those different regimes, right? So we can then, we can then say things systematically about role of network structure. We can even come up with control strategies. Like here's a little example of this four-node network that's in the endemic regime. And because we know as a function of these numbers how to move it into other regimes, like how to move it into the infection-free regime, we can simply, this is just like a little modification where we take agent two, increase its recovery rate by a little bit, and we move this from one regime into the other, so we get rid of the infection. This is an example where we just change one of the infection rates. We lower it, reinfection rates, and we don't get to the infection, we get to the epidemic regime, but that at least in steady state gets rid of the infection. Here's an example where all we do is rewire, and we get rid of the endemic solution. And here's another larger example where, if some individuals aren't going to change on reinfection. Some are going to get compromised immunity. Some are going to get partial immunity. You can ask these questions of like, who should I vaccinate? Who should I expose to the infection? If I only can expose a couple, who should I do? And so this is just showing you that you can think about this systematically. I want to do, you know, expose some of the ones who are going to gain partial immunity so that the group as a whole will get out of this kind of endemic solution. And it turns out that Agent 11 is super influential. So this is like thinking about sort of centrality measures of spreading this kind of infectious process, right? But this is just my final summary. You know, that this idea was using analytically tractable models. They allow us for to do these systematic investigation of mechanisms. In this case, it helped us explain resilience and spreading processes. So key were this idea of modifying susceptibility after first exposure to the environment. I didn't have time to get into it, but like the story is really all about these sort of negative and positive feedback loops that allow you to, you know, destabilize and stabilize at different timescales. Super important. The role of interconnection topology and heterogeneity play into this. The generalizability allows us to think about other species, other contexts. Also design, how do we control or enhance spreading? And, you know, so we're, you know, this is part of the conversations that we're having, you know, thinking about, for instance, you know, not just spreading of disease here, even though we're using epidemiological models, how we spread responses to neighbors. This is a video that I borrowed from Jacob of, you know, a heterogeneous group of fish that get perturbed and try to understand how they react, how we get these kinds of spreading behaviors. We're looking at things like multi-layer, you know, what if you're fusing like visual networks and lateral line networks, how does that play into all this kind of story? But I will stop there. Thank you very much.